All right, guys, so the name of this lecture is How to Make a Good Case. Great. Now, there's a lot of things that go into a debate round, and one thing I found with a lot of advanced students is they think, like, oh, I got this case thing down. I can just write a case in half an hour, debate it, and I'll win all of my debate rounds, and it'll be easy, no problem. And they just tend to do the same things over and over again and don't actually try to get better at writing their cases. They try to get better at their speaking. They try to get better at their organization. They work a lot on their cross-examination. But they don't really understand what it takes, the fine-tuning that goes into making a really good case. So this is all about fine-tuning your case. This isn't about writing a case. These are things that you can use to take a case that you already have, make small changes that really make a huge difference. Now, another thing about advanced students, I'm just going to talk about myself as an example here, is that we try to get really, really complicated with cases. We start running things like, you know, unified analysis case, or we want to run this special set of contentions that work in this special way that no one has ever thought of before. And the thing you have to understand about cases is that it has all been tried before. Everyone has tried every single kind of case out there. So while I definitely encourage you to test out unique case structures, they can be really fun. There's a reason why they use the case structure that's the traditional Lincoln Douglas case structure. That's because the traditional structure is just the best structure that there is. Having three contentions, if you can find three separate points to talk about, is definitely going to get more content across to your judge than having a single contention with a ton of content or eight contentions with hardly any content in them. So I'd just like to review what a case is. I know this seems incredibly basic, but I found myself asking myself these questions even going into NITOC. What am I even trying to accomplish with this case? And a case is really an answer to the underlying question of the resolution. It's a reason that you're telling your judge to do something. Now, it seems obvious, but a lot of cases I find don't really actually advocate a change in position. They don't really advocate a change in belief, something that we should change about how we see reality. They just are a bunch of arguments, and they just do all these steps to win the argument. They may even do things like preempting arguments, but they don't really come back to actually impacting it to the judge and impacting it to the resolution. A little word on how important cases are and why you should spend a lot of time on your cases is that your case is your foundation for the debate. Everything that happens in the debate round comes from your case. A lot of people begin wondering what really is what does it mean to have a new argument? Some people think that having a new argument is bringing up a new application. Some people think that you can't even bring up a new application against your opponent's case because that's technically part of your rebuttals, not your constructives. I've heard other people say that you can basically do whatever you want as long as you don't have the last speech. And I like to think of having new arguments as being anything that isn't in your case, and any argument that isn't in your case. This isn't necessarily true, but here's the thing. I don't mean that you can't bring up any new applications, and I certainly don't mean that you can't attack your opponent's value. What I do mean is that your case has a message. Your case has a thesis, and if you stray from that thesis, if you start up bringing new arguments that have impacts outside of your case, it does two things. First of all, it really is a new argument. It's an entirely new reason to affirm or negate the resolution. For the first negative speech, that's probably okay. But for the affirmative, it isn't. But second of all, you don't even want to do that. What's a reason that you would not want to bring up a new argument? What's a reason that that could actually hurt you? Emily?
It kind of distracts the judge from what you want them to focus on.
Exactly. Your case is what you want your judge to focus on. You want your case to be the defining issue in the round. We're going to talk about that in depth a little bit later. But when you bring up an argument outside of your case, you're really distracting your judge from what your thesis is. All of a sudden, instead of having one unified single reason to vote against the resolution, he has a bunch of fragmented reasons that maybe aren't even explained to him that well. If all of your reasons come out from your thesis, basically your core reason, did we talk about having a thesis statement? That you guys have been robbed. The novice students know more about this than you do then. Or my students do anyways, because we talk about thesis statements. Let's talk about thesis statements a little bit, because really the thesis statement is what it takes to understand what a case is. Does anyone know what a thesis is? Kind of? Ray?
It kind of like sums up your main point, like your overall thesis.
Exactly. A thesis statement is actually something that occurs in all writing. All writing has a thesis, except for some, like, kind of postmodern novel kind of stuff that can get weird and doesn't have a thesis. But any kind of academic writing has a thesis. Sometimes that thesis isn't explicitly stated, but it's there all the same. More thesis statements in a second. Your case is your first word. How many of you have been told to refute your opponent's case and then give your case? This is why I don't think you should do that. Your case is your chance to be perfect. Let me say that again. Your case is your chance to be perfect. You have unlimited prep time for your case. You can make your case whatever you want to be. You can script it so that every word has perfect impact, if you do it well. You can choose every single word you say and memorize it, just like a speech. The arguments you make up against your opponent's case aren't even going to be close in terms of the quality of your case. Your case is the highest quality thing you have to say. So first of all, I think you should give your case first, because it really frames your arguments that you're going to use against your opponent. It allows you to deal with their arguments more quickly and more efficiently, and in a way that makes more sense to the judge. Second of all, it gives a higher quality to the round and allows your judge to remember your arguments more, instead of remembering your opponent's arguments more. If you start the round talking about your opponent's case, what is that telling your judge? You're telling the judge that their case is the most important issue in the round. And we're basically, mine's just a little afterword that's an alternative that you might want to look at after we've debated the merits of my opponent's case. So your case should be your first word. And your case is your chance to be perfect. So anyways, I'm going to leave you with three steps on how to have a great case. The first step is to have clarity. Have clarity. And unfortunately, some debaters, almost not intentionally, they don't actually ever say this, but it's almost like as they get quote-unquote better, they get more complicated. They make things harder to understand instead of easier to understand. That is a huge mistake. The better you get, the more clear you should be. Having complicated, weird arguments is never a good idea. That's one reason that judges don't like critiques. Critiques are rarely easy to understand. And even if so, they don't have a lot of impact. That's a side note. The better you get, the more you should focus on having clarity. And I am going right now to give you the secret to having clarity, both in your case and also to having clarity throughout the entire round. And that's what I said that I wasn't going to talk about. Turns out it was in my notes. Having a thesis. Clarity comes from both knowing and communicating your thesis. Now, a thesis statement, like Ray was saying, is basically having a one-sentence summary about what your case is. We should negate the resolution because when we value freedom over economic security, it harms the well-being of the nation. That would be a thesis. So, there's two steps to developing a thesis. The first is to reword the resolution as a question. Reword the resolution as a question. The resolution is asking a question to each debater. For example, I'm just going to take the Stowe resolution because it's so easy to remember. I'm still having a hard time remembering word for word what the NCSA resolution is. But the question that the resolution is asking the affirmative is, why is privacy undervalued? The question that the resolution is asking the negative is, why is privacy not undervalued? So you first want to reword the resolution as a question. The NCSU resolution would go something like, why do nations have a moral obligation to assist other nations in need. I know it's not quite exactly the way it goes, but something like that. Why do nations have a moral obligation to assist those in need? The negative would be asked, why do nations not have a moral obligation to assist other nations in need? So, after you reword the resolution as a question, it's very simple, yet kind of difficult to make a thesis at the same time. Sometimes the simplest things are the hardest to do. You give a one-sentence answer to that question. You simply answer that question with one sentence. Now, as you write your case, it's important to know your thesis, but at the same time, your thesis may evolve as the year goes on. Your reason for why the resolution should be true or false may change as the year goes on. You may think, well, it's really not so more that the nation's security is going to be harmed. I'm more talking about how individuals themselves are going to be harmed. Or, I'm not so much talking about why nations... Actually, I don't know that resolution enough to tell you what an evolution of that might look like. But I know last year, I started out with this case like the thesis I told you, but then my thinking kind of evolved into saying, my thesis was basically we have no way of knowing if the resolution is true. So it kind of evolved into a critique, and then I scrapped it for nationals and went back to my old thesis. Just to give you an example of how theses can change. But everything must come back to your thesis. Everything that you say in the debate round has to fit into that theme. Theme isn't the right word, because we're going to talk about theme in a minute. And Travis talked to you about a theme a little bit earlier. But it's going to come back to that central message. As the year's beginning, I would urge you to start by just writing a few theses for each side of the resolution. Answer the resolution, answer that question with three different answers. If you can give three different answers to each of those questions, you all of a sudden have six different cases. Then all you have to do is pick your favorite thesis and build a case off that thesis. That is the simplest way to find your favorite case out there. Because I can guarantee you, there's a lot of cases out there, but there's rarely going to be more than three major themes. Now, the theses may change a little bit, be a little bit different, emphasize different things within that general category, but they're all going to be very similar. So if you can find out three different reasons, first of all, it's going to help you develop a case you know you're going to enjoy. Because you know, hey, this is the thesis that really speaks to me the most. But also, once you kind of understand what the major theses out there are, it'll be that much easier for you to anticipate every single case that comes against you. So, a side note, having a thesis can really help you have clarity as to what an opponent's case is well. If an argument isn't a part of your thesis, it shouldn't be part of your arguments. If something isn't a part of your thesis, it should not be part of your arguments. That's what I was talking about when we were talking about new arguments. First of all, if you have something that doesn't really fit into your thesis, all of a sudden you're communicating to your judge, first of all, an entirely different theme. You guys talked a little bit about themes earlier. But you're also communicating to your judge an entirely different case. If you all of a sudden give a reason to negate the resolution that has nothing to do with what your arguments were before, then it doesn't really belong. If that's what you're wanting to do, then just do direct refutation against your opponent's case. And just don't have a thesis. Just basically saying my opponent is wrong. But if you're going to write a case, then have everything fit back into that case. The second step to having a really good case is to have your case define the conflict. Now, some resolutions specifically say the word conflict in them. In fact, I'd say at least half of Lincoln-Douglas resolutions talk about a conflict between two different arguments. Now, neither of the resolutions, either in NCFCA or STOA, specifically say that they're the word conflict. However, there is a conflict in every resolution. Actually, there's probably lots of conflicts in each resolution. Let's take a look at the NCFCA resolution. Governments have a moral obligation to assist nations in need. Now, there's a lot of different values in conflict right there. We have values like peace, sanctity of life, even things like the general welfare, but we also have ideas at place like limited government, colonialism. There's lots of different things that are conflicting with each other. even arguments like limited government is conflicting with the protection of life. I know that might hurt the souls of conservatives, so I'll feel like limited government is always going to protect lives. But it's really a conflict between, are we going to save lives in other nations, or are we allowing the government to become too big and simply dictate all these different areas? So that's an example of how there's all of these different conflicts. Your case should exemplify and really build off of one of those conflicts. You need to pick the single conflict that is at issue in the debate round and focus on that one. And this has a lot to do with your thesis, although your thesis is pretty broad. It doesn't necessarily specifically lay out the resolution. For example, I'd just like to talk about my case in Stoa just because I know a lot about it. And actually, I'm wishing I had written it a little bit differently, because when I wrote it, I didn't really understand fact resolutions. But there is a way to use information, my criterion, really as a measuring stick criterion instead of a means. But in any case, the conflict I decided to bring out of that is that privacy is not undervalued, because right now, privacy is conflicting with security. They are at odds. It's a zero-sum game. When you choose privacy, you have less security. When you choose security, you have less privacy. That's not necessarily always true, but that's just nonetheless the conflict I chose, because sometimes having more privacy can also increase your security. But in any case, the center issue that I bring out in my case is this conflict between security and privacy. And that's really important. You want your case to be the center issue of the debate. Whether or not, if you're the affirmative, the negative, it's the easiest to do. I think Travis was talking about how negatives have a strategic advantage because they get to set the tone of the rebuttals. They get to set the tone of, these are going to be the issues that I have with my opponent's case. Now, the affirmative has the persuasive edge because they have the first and last speech, but the negative really gets to define the debate round, gets to define the rebuttal. So the affirmative gets to define the resolution, but the negative gets to define what issues inside of the resolution are going to become major issues. So defining the conflict is the easiest to do for the negative, because you can simply do it in your rebuttals. However, a good affirmative case and a good negative case should all define the conflict within the case themselves. Even before the rebuttals ever come up, it needs to become a conflict. For example, last year in my affirmative case, I specifically was looking at the issue of how it was really easy last year. Personal freedom and economic security are conflicting. But I was basically arguing how it's a debate between the worth of the individual and selfishness. I was pretty straightforward about my opponent's side of the resolution is selfish. Not necessarily what you want to do, but it nonetheless defined the conflict in the resolution. My opponent is now forced to confront this issue of, am I going to do the selfless thing and, you know, not sell people into human trafficking, or am I going to do the selfish thing that's just going to benefit me at the expense of others? Just by refuting their case, they should be adopting your conflict. It's kind of an interesting idea. A key to remember here is that you can't win on your opponent's case. Let me repeat that. You cannot win your opponent's case. You can only not lose. I'm not sure if you've heard this yet, this camp. I certainly talked to the novices a little bit. But at the very least, your opponent's arguments, you can only not lose. Let's say you completely annihilated them. You completely annihilated your opponent's case and it just vaporized. It's no longer there. Your judge still doesn't have a reason to vote for you. He only doesn't have a reason to vote for your opponent. So you're not actually making any ground by completely eliminating your opponent's case. You may be making some ground with the judge in terms of, look, I just annihilated my opponent's case. How cool is that? And the judge is like, yeah, you really did kill him, so I'll vote for you. But in terms of just the arguments, you're not actually making any ground. So instead of trying to necessarily destroy your opponent's case, you almost want to bring the conflict that you were talking about, your case, up against your opponent's case. You refute your opponent's case with yours. A lot of people like to think of the rebuttal as like, I'm going to give my case, and then we're going to leave my case behind and go destroy my opponent's case. That is not true at all. In fact, it's very difficult to do because you're already thinking about the issues in your case. But also, it's a terrible idea. Why would you leave the issues that you've decided are the key reasons why the resolution is either true or false, and completely leave those at the door when you go to talk about your opponent's case? You want your case to define the conflict in the round, both within your case, but also inside of your rebuttals. A way that you can think about defining the conflict is what is called assignation. Assignation. And if you look up this up in the dictionary, there's a couple of meanings to this. The meaning I mean out of assignation is the act of assigning something. Pretty simple. The idea is that you are wanting to assign your opponent a position. You're basically saying, Judge, this is the position that my opponent is holding. Or at least, this is the position my opponent needs to hold, because this is his side of the resolution. And you start talking about the other side of the resolution. And you can even say you can say this almost explicitly. Judge, if we affirm the resolution, X, X, and X is going to happen. If we affirm the resolution, we would have to believe this. Right there, you are assigning your opponent a position. You're saying, if you agree with my opponent, you have to agree with these things. Now, that might not necessarily be strictly true. Your opponent might not necessarily be saying that, but that's what your case is about. You're saying, these are the issues on the two sides of the resolution. Let's look at this side, and let's look at the other side. You preferably want to assign your opponent an impossible position. You want to set it up to where it's like the only possible choice that the judge could ever make would be to vote for you. And you do this once again by pulling this conflict into every single area of the round. This is another little side note. Your voting issues should be in your case. Your voting issues should be in your case. This is a really crazy idea at first, when you first think about this. But really, your voting issues are the key issues in the round. What is your case?
The key
issues in the round. Exactly. If you have another key issue that wasn't in your case, it's a new argument. So every single voting issue that you come up with should be an issue in the round. Now, a little side note on the impact on what kind of voting issues you should choose. Applications is not a voting issue. I see this one all the time. And that's okay. I mean, that's okay. Not shaming you guys. Applications is not a voting issue. It's not an issue. It's a sub-point. It's like a stock issue, basically, in Lincoln Douglas debate, if you know the terminology from team policy. Application is a category. It's not an argument. All of your voting issues need to be arguments. Little freebie ad right there. An argument would be something like, the real world proves the resolution false, or the real world proves the resolution true. Something like that. That would be an actual argument, and you're talking about the applications. But I think it would be better almost to have your contentions be your voting issues. Isn't that a crazy idea? I used to have three contentions. And this was my standard formula, and it still works really well, just not for this resolution. For when you have two different issues in the round, what I'd have is contention one, why my value is good. And you could also run that as a value link instead. Contention two, why my opponent doesn't get my value. Contention three, why I do. But in any case, I would use those as my standard three voting issues. First one is the values, why my value is the best. Second of all, how my opponent fails to achieve my value. Third, how I do. And you can still run, that's a standard voting issue layout. You can try to use those. But in any case, all the issues in the round, including your voting issues, should come from your case. This does not mean that you can't bring up new applications. This does not mean that you can't bring up philosophers. In fact, that's a really dumb idea. Why not bring up new applications? Why not bring up new real-world examples? As long as they prove the argument that you made earlier. As long as they lead your judge back to the argument you made. Yeah, Zach?
So in other words, evidence should be treated in the same way as a piece of, like a TP evidence book, correct?
That is one way to think about it. There's definitely some carryover there. A piece of evidence, especially it's really useful to think of this as the affirmative. A piece of evidence is proving your case. it's going back to a reason why in policy, why we should change a policy. In Lincoln Douglas, it's a reason why we should change or at least adopt a certain viewpoint. So here's a really fun advanced strategy about how to define the conflict in the round. How to bring your thesis directly against your opponent. It's called setting up your case in cross-examination. This is my ultimate favorite strategy for cross-examination. Now, in cross-examination, there are basically two things that you're trying to accomplish. Does anyone argue in terms of logically? There's a lot of things you're trying to accomplish in terms of showing the judge you're more macho or all of those kinds of things. Ignoring that, just looking at the arguments, what are the two kinds of things that you're trying to achieve in cross-examination? James?
Admissions and clarifications.
Admissions. Okay. What kind of admissions are you looking for? That's a good question. What are the two kinds of admissions that you're trying to look for in cross-examination? Emily?
Ones that prove your case true and ones that prove your opponent's case false.
Have you been looking at my notes? Okay. she just hangs out with me a little too much, I guess.
She's your sister.
Yes. So, in any case, arguments should both prove your opponent's case false, but they should also prove your case true. Now, most people only try to do the first one, and that's how we're often taught. Is just look at the flow of your opponent's case and just attack it. But here's the thing. Why not ask them some questions that have nothing to do about their case? After all, their case is not the main issue in the round, right? Your case is the main issue in the round. At least that's the viewpoint that you want to adopt. You want to be thinking of, what are the main issues that I'm trying to argue? Let's just say, let's take a step back from your case. Let's just talk about the resolution here. And just start asking them some questions. Some general questions that are building your case. And that is what we were doing in our cross-examination workshop. That's what we were talking about. What are the admissions that you're trying to get? What are the arguments that you're going to try to prove? And start setting those up in cross-examination. Now, you can certainly try to set up arguments that just say your opponent's case is false. But you can also show arguments that show why your case is true. The individual rights one was an example of that. That doesn't only really attack your opponent's case. Because the issue of the definition of individual rights probably was not a main issue in your opponent's case. Because they don't want it to be an issue. They understand that it's a weakness. It's a strength of yours. Now, can anyone guess what side this strategy works best for? Sam?
Negative.
Definitely negative. And why is that?
Because the affirmative already, or you already know the... When you're affirmative, they already know your case.
Exactly. The negative has the element of surprise in cross-examination. The affirmative doesn't really know where you're going with stuff. We talked about the cliff and the flowers and the trees and all that kind of stuff. It's a lot harder to sell the flowers and the trees when they've already been thrown off the cliff before when they heard your case. It still can be done, but it's a lot harder. With the negative, it's more friendly. I have not yet to disagree with you, so let's talk about these things. They haven't seen your case yet. So practice setting up literally every element of your case in the debate round. Every contention should have some cross-examination applied to it. The values should have something applied to it. Why do we value what you value? Is your value truly good all of the time? Is such and such a valuable concept? All of these things are setting up the value conflict between your value and theirs. The third step is something that I didn't realize this, but you guys talked about for an entire lecture yesterday. So you guys talked a ton about themes last night, but I had my own little thing on themes. I didn't realize that Travis was going to give an entire lecture on it, but I prepared some fun stuff with themes, so I thought we'd still do that.
Yeah.
The third step, though, transcends theme, or I should say, I feel like it's a little more broad than what Travis is talking about. The third step to making a truly great case is to give something to believe in. Give something to believe in. It's one thing to give your judge a case that they can understand. Give your judge a logical case. Here's the thing. The judges already know that you're smart. They already know that you're a genius. Let's just assume that. They already know the elder brain has reached the highest echelons of logical thinking possible for man. But at the same time, they're listening to elder brain saying, he is at just such a high level of greatness that I could never possibly be up there with elder brain. And it might be true. But the thing is that that's not what you want to communicate to your judge. You want to communicate to your judge, this is something that's both clear and you can understand, but also it's something that you cannot just understand, but truly believe in. Your judges know you're smart. Now they want to vote for you. They want to vote for you. Here's the thing. There's really a few different elements at play. Have you guys talked about logos, ethos, and pathos this debate camp? Not really. Let's just get ethos out of the way. That's basically credibility. So dress nicely. Don't be annoying. Those kinds of things. You'll be credible.
Don't lie.
And you'll be likable. Logos is logic. That's what actually the name of our club is Logos. It's a really awesome name. And that's really important. You definitely don't want to leave logic behind. If you don't have logic, you can talk really well, and all you're going to be end up doing is convincing your judge of something that's a logical fallacy. So you really don't want to do that. It's not only a bad idea, it's not very effective. The third element is pathos. Pathos is what is known as passion. Passion is having, is communicating passion for the theme, passion for your case to your judge, to where your judge should be just as enthusiastic about your case as you are. That should be your goal at the end of every time you give your case. Your judge should be like, oh, holy smokes. And it's the same thing with all of your speeches. All of your speeches, by the time that you reach the end of your speech, your judge should be just as enthusiastic about your topic as you pretended to be. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, by the end, let's be honest, you gave your speech 20-something times already. You might not feel that passionate about your topic, but you want to communicate that passion to your judge nonetheless. Style beats logic 60% of the time or more. Style beats logic 60% of the time or more. I believe this firmly. And you're going to hear about this a little bit later with the lecture, Debating Like a Champion by Travis. But basically, judges, this is a really cool thing that Travis told me. It's probably next to the point that time equals importance. This was probably the second most important thing that I ever learned. And that was in prelims at just a qualifier, being the champion, acting like the champion, regardless of the arguments, is going to factor into about 30% of your judge's decision. In the first out round, it becomes about 40%. In semis and finals, it gets to about 50 and 60% of your judge's decisions. At regionals, it's even more. Let's just talk at at nationals, just in prelims, it's going to be about 50% of your judge's decision is who deserves to win this debate round. Not just who won it, but who deserves to win this debate round. Who do I want to vote for? About 60% in prelims is about who's the champion? Who deserves to go to outrounds? In outrounds, outround one. You have to understand, like at NITOC, there's double elimination. So how many outrounds was there? It was like 13?
Overall, nine.
There's nine outrounds. Okay. No, outrounds? No, total. Alright, let's say nine outrounds. That's insane. If the first outround is 70% of your judge's decision, goodness. What about finals? Finals at nationals is at least 90% about who deserves to win. Not who won, not the flow, but who is the champion. Em?
Which is why you did not win.
In
but
I won his case also.
Don't win that.
By only
don't defend yourself, just point her to your trophy.
Let's, like John Bateman, you guys were talking about the dress, how he was dressing. John Bateman looked like the champion in that final round. He's a little roguish, Or actually, he's very roguish. with his curly hair and all of that. But at the same time, as the rogue, he looks more professional than this other guy who's like the lawyer, basically. So anyway, style beats logic 60% of the time or more. However, style and logic beat pure logic almost every time. If you have style and logic, and your opponent only has logic, and you lose, it's either because you had an incredibly biased judge, some kind of bias that you didn't know about and weren't able to take advantage of, or the judge was falling asleep or something. Because it's just not going to happen. If you have beat them on style and beat them on logic, you're going to win almost every single time. So this is not a reason not to have logic, but it definitely is a huge reason to give your judge something to believe in. Giving your judge something to believe in, your inspiration comes from your theme. And your theme is basically the inspiration, the real-life application, the emotion that comes with your thesis. Your thesis is 100% metaphysical. It's just an idea. It's actually an assertion. It's not even an argument. You're just saying something. Your whole case is there to prove your thesis, to turn it into an argument. But your theme is what gives it an emotional side. All of your applications, if possible, should add to your theme. Your theme could be something like, my opponent is, like, dark and murderous, and I'm all patriotic. Like, subnotes like that. Like, I'm just going to say this. And I sort of moved more towards the, quote, dark side of Lincoln Douglas the later I got into debate. And the dark side of Lincoln Douglas debate is basically just the emotional appeal, the thing that the team policy people just hate, basically. And it's the idea, it's like, he didn't even say anything. He just talked about babies being held, you know? But anyways, it's because we both had logic. For, just to kind of communicate this, like what I was saying about me joining the dark side, I had an application of human trafficking and euthanization of mentally ill people in Nazi Germany against my opponent. And then for me, I started out with the American Revolution and the Scottish Revolution. And then I changed it to the American Revolution and then, like, German outlaws, the people who broke the law to try to save Jews, gypsies, gays, and people like that were trying to be killed. Really quick, I just want to throw out some themes from movies that can kind of help communicate to you what theme is like. Can anyone tell me what the theme from Spider-Man is?
Which one? Shooting webs.
Anyone? Not Emily.
Responsibility.
Basically, you got it.
Yeah, that's just a big thing.
With great power comes great responsibility. If adventure has a name, it must be Indiana Jones. And that's the whole theme of Indiana Jones. Like, regardless of what happens, all we care about is the adventure. For my favorite, every man dies, not every man really lives. And to every man, he just envisions himself sitting next to Mel Gibson with his face painted, dressed in leather, all this hair everywhere, holding a pike, screaming freedom as the English charge him. I mean, it's just so awesome. And that you're communicating this theme, you're just like envisioning yourself being with Mel Gibson. Or the more popular theme, because things can have multiple themes. They may take our lives, but they will never take our freedom! So that concludes this lecture.